I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time to head to the beauty shop, where we ask the ladies to give their perspective on what's happening in the news. This week, we're talking about the execution of Troy Davis, a new book that talks about the role that women had at the Obama White House. Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the former head of the IMF, confesses to a moral failing, but nothing criminal. And as if one weren't enough, we now have a spinoff of The Real Housewives of Atlanta. So joining us to talk about all this are Nia Malika Henderson, national political reporter for The Washington Post, and Emmanuel, professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, Viviana Hurtado, she's blogger-in-chief of the website The Wise Latina Club, and Danielle Belton, she's behind the pop culture and politics blog The Black Snob. Ladies, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Hey there.
We're going to start on a bit of a down note, which is no matter what your opinion is about it, whether you're in favor of the death penalty or not, Troy Davis was executed late last night in connection with the 1989 shooting death of off-duty police officer Mark McPhail. This was a case that attracted international attention, a broad coalition of legal professionals and prominent individuals from the political left and the right said that they felt that there was just too much doubt about Davis's guilt because of a lack of physical evidence, because 7 of the 9 trial witnesses had recanted their testimony over the course of time. And I just want to play a short clip from Reverend Raphael Warnock, pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church. He was speaking at one of the vigils that was held last night as activists were hoping for a last-minute reprieve from the Supreme Court, which, of course, did not occur.
We did not want to lose Troy Davis as a casualty of this war, but I do think that his execution, in a real sense, will only add momentum to the movement of those of us who understand that the state really cannot be trusted with the ultimate punishment.
I also want to say that Mr. Davis maintained his innocence consistently, but Officer McPhail's family also had a very strong view that he was guilty. And we heard from Officer McPhail's mother, Annalise McPhail, last night, and she told the Associated Press that all these feelings of relief and peace that I've been waiting for all these years, they will come later. I certainly do want some peace. So, Danielle, I just have to ask you, what is your sense of this? It seems like we haven't had one of these in a long time where people have really galvanized around a particular case.
It's particularly depressing to me because as strongly as I feel for people who are victims who have loved ones taken from them and some of the more heinous crimes involve people being killed, their lives being taken away, the state should not be in the business of vengeance. The state is not, I mean, our legal system is a wonderful legal system, but it's not completely perfect. It's not 100% fail-proof, and you can't take back a death. If you kill the wrong guy, there's no restitution you can do to bring a person back. And that's what really is troubling to me, especially considering I believe the United States is the only Western culture country that still has the death penalty and uses it in this manner. It's just it's still disturbing to me that we're still having this discussion.
Professor Emmanuel, what is it about this case that, as I mentioned, that there are a lot of high-profile individuals from across the political spectrum? I'm thinking of former FBI Director William Sessions, former Congressman, Republican Congressman Bob Barr, in addition to those who oppose the death penalty in all cases, like, for example, former President Jimmy Carter, united to bring attention to this case. What is it about this case that was so disturbing that got so much attention?
It's the weakness of the evidence, and I think it bears emphasizing that the case is a very, very weak case even before any of the witnesses recant. I think, in fact, the focus on the recantation, which is what gets the attention for the case, also confuses some people because the legal system, I think quite rightly and necessarily, is not wide open to recantations. We take testimony once, and it takes a lot to let somebody say, would you redo this so I can tell you a different story. But the problem with this case is, even before any of the witnesses recant, the state's case is very thin to support a conviction, let alone a death penalty. By that I mean it's made up of, I would say, 3 elements. Hearsay. Hearsay we all know is inherently less credible, less trustworthy than the direct testimony. In this case, it was admissible because it was characterized as admissions of interest. People testified that Troy Davis told them he had confessed. They later recanted. Eyewitnesses that have no indicia of credibility. An eyewitness who, at the time of the crime, said, I couldn't identify anyone, which is not surprising since it happened around 2 in the morning in a dark parking lot. There were approximately 5 men in one vicinity. There were 5 men in the area of the crime, leaving Officer McPhail out, and all of them were strangers to this man. And yet, after Troy Davis's picture was in the news and on television and all around the world, 2 years later, he was allowed to come into the courtroom and say he could identify Troy Davis as the shooter. And then the third piece was the ballistics. The state at trial said they could connect Troy Davis to a bullet fired earlier at a party in a neighborhood, a different neighborhood. The bullet they retrieved from that victim, who was not killed, it was an aggravated assault, they said might have matched the bullet that was retrieved from Officer McPhail's body after his tragic death.
So there was. So you're saying that it just even before the recantation, this case was
before,
so weak
because that, so, ballistics so, only. But if I could just finish that, yeah. Ballistics said might have the new 2007 ballistics report says there are not sufficient similarities to allow us to make a connection.
I understand. If I could just ask you briefly before
sure.
we move on, is there anything? Do you think this could happen again today?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's why people are aligned against it. And I think you were right in your introduction. Many, many people who oppose the death penalty oppose it not on absolute moral or legal or ethical grounds, but on the grounds that we have seen over and over that we cannot and do not implement it accurately and fairly. And that's the showstopper.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly visit to the beauty shop. That's where we get the women's take on issues in the news and pop culture. With us this week are Anne Emanuel. She's professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. That's who was speaking just now. Danielle Belton of TheBlackSnob.com, Viviana Hurtado of WiseLatinaClub.com, and Nia Malika Henderson of The Washington Post. We want to move on now and talk about a new book by a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Ron Suskind. It's called Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. And in it, he says some rather, I don't want to describe it as unflattering things about the president, but certainly some unflattering and rather surprising things about the White House that over which he presides. He says that early in the administration, women in senior positions in the White House had a hard time getting in front of the president. They felt isolated from him. In fact, some called it a hostile work environment. This is a clip of Ron Suskind on the Today Show. He's being interviewed by host Ann Curry.
You quote Christina Romer, the former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, as saying, "I felt like a piece of meat when she was excluded from a meeting." And also, you quote former White House Communications Director Anita Dunn, quoting her, calling the White House, quote, "a genuinely hostile workplace to women." Now, both of these women have subsequently denied making these comments. How do you respond to that?
Everyone is under a great deal of pressure. It's a political season. The fact of the matter is, all of them said everything. We have extensive notes and tapes for this book. And the fact is, with Anita Dunn, as with most of the other subjects, they were told what would be said next to them, what they said in the book.
Nia, needless to say, this is not a depiction that you would think, you know, President Obama, he of, you know, the wise, beautiful, and talented Michelle Obama, you know, who would like to, the father of two daughters. I'm sure this is not a picture that he is appreciating. Now, you spent a lot of time at the White House. What do you make of it?
Well, it rings true, mostly. And I think one of the things that Suskind also says is that the White House in some ways pushed him to write about this issue, this women's issue, and the problems that they were having on the White House, because there was a feeling that President Obama moved to correct it. Early on in this White House, if you think back even when he would have these golf outings and basketball games and there were no women that were invited, there was a move to invite women to a golf outing. Melody Barnes, in fact, was one of the first women to go out and hit the links with the president. And, you know, I think obviously there have been some denials. I spoke with Anita Dunn on Friday about this, and she pushed back against some of this. But even in talking to White House folks privately, there is a sense that a lot of this was true and felt even among the reporting class in reporting on this White House, that there was this sort of impenetrable boys club that women reporters couldn't always get access to the players in the way that male reporters would. You know, there would always be this sports lingo that some women might not always get, so much so that Valerie Jarrett moved to have these private meetings with female reporters where we could get access to Valerie, because, of course, she's a player in that White House. So it's certainly something the White House is pushing back very much against this book. But I think there is also a sense that a lot of this is true, and that also that a lot of it has been shifted. There's almost like the post there's the pre-Rahm Emanuel era and then the post-Rahm Emanuel era.
Viviana, what do you make of it? Now, you've spent a lot of time in Washington. As a lot of the women here have worked in kind of very male environments, what do you make of it?
I think that one of the things that stands out is that there's just something that's going to be natural in most work environments about relationship building. And if the campaign was very masculine and if a lot of his most inner circle people, the president's most inner circle people were men, and that was developed at the campaign, that makes sense. But there's something really interesting about the title, the education of the president, and also what Ron Suskin himself said on the Today clip that you played, which was, it's a political season. And I ask myself, why now? And it's interesting that the president is very vulnerable as this campaign season is ramping up. It's something that the way it plays out in the media, the sound bites, the headlines you hear, makes the president seem like he's just this anti-woman, big jock about to say, huh. And I think that's something that it's a strategy, it's a machine that I feel is relentless and peeling away at voters that this president at a very vulnerable stage is going to need. And just very quickly, I was also going to mention that I believe that if indeed the White House pressed Suskin to write this book, it seems time and time again this president is having a big this White House is having a big issue around messaging and communications. Hmm. They think that they're thinking that it's going to be A, and it turns out to be Z.
I'm still trying to figure out how that works when you press somebody to write a book. That doesn't work that way in my world. I don't get people calling me pressing me to write.
Think this particular issue, at least this was Suskin's version of it, they did want him to talk about the women's issue because they felt like, even Anita Dunn felt like, the president was doing something to change it. They had this dinner in November 2009, and that he was making steps to make this different and to make women feel more included in that White House. So that's what Suskin's version of it is.
You know, it's interesting that we're talking about this the same week, and obviously we chose this, but that the whole issue of the way women are treated in the workplace is surfaced once again, because I really don't think we've been talking about it that much in recent years. And one question, of course, I would have is, did anybody apply the same standard to George W. Bush, mm-hmm. George H.W. Bush? You know, and prior White Houses, certainly, you know, President Clinton's White House, were people applying the same standard in terms of what the office environment was to them? But, you know, I don't know the answer to that. But I want to ask about, we want to talk about this whole question of Dominique Strauss-Kahn. We talked about that previously on this program. Went on French television this week to concede moral failure regarding his sexual encounter with New York hotel maid Nasfiatou Diallo. And let me just give you a piece of tape. Actually, this is Eleanor Beardsley reports in Paris. She's translating for him, but here it is.
Ce qui s'est passé, c'est une relation non seulement inappropriée, mais plus que ça.
What happened involved no aggression or violence, said Strauss-Kahn. But I admit it was more than inappropriate. It was a moral shortcoming on my part towards my wife, my family, and the French people who placed their faith in me.
Professor Emanuel, I understand completely different legal system. Of course, this happened in New York. But I do want to ask you really the same question I was asking earlier, which is there anything to be learned from this?
I note in the Strauss-Kahn case, I think the district attorney's problem in going forward was he looked at the evidence and realized he had a swearing contest. And that makes it a hard case in which to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, regardless of what the district attorney thinks of the actual truth of the matter. I wish that the district attorney in the Troy Davis case had taken a hard look at the evidence he had before they decided to move so decisively against Troy Davis, because, as I said, I don't think it supports the conviction, let alone the death sentence. And I think it relates to the gender bias story, too. I think one of the lessons there is that longstanding and deeply entrenched biases don't die easily, don't disappear easily. And I think part of the problem with the Troy Davis case is he was a black teenager in Savannah.
Hmm. In 1989. Danielle, what do you think of this? Does this put a bow on this for you, He's sorry.
This is just so typical.
He's sorry.
Oh, I'm so sorry. It was a moral failing this time. You know, all the other times where I cheated on my wife or sexually harassed a woman or maybe even possibly pressured a woman into doing something sexual with me, those were fine. But this one time where it blew up in my face and it became like a national international incident, I'm sorry for this one, honey. I'm really sorry to put you and France through it. I'm like, please.
Okay. Well, speaking of please, we have to, before we let you all go, evidently one was not enough. The Real Housewives of Atlanta, you don't have to tell me whether you watch it or not. I'm not asking for disclosures here. Apparently now there's going to be a spinoff of Kim, who was the only white cast member, okay? Regular cast member. Now she's getting a spinoff. Danielle, you are rolling your eyes so hard. I fear for your head.
Is she really, why Kim? Is she really the breakout star? Because I could argue that NeNe is technically the breakout star, but she gets the spinoff. Like, I don't care because I don't watch it, but I just find that highly suspect.
Okay, Viviana, are you going to watch it?
Probably not. I'm just going to really work very hard, though, on figuring out how I can get my own reality show. And I think it's going to likely, I'm going to have to get some serious plastic surgery up top. And
oh,
I'm not talking about my brain.
Oh, dear. Oh, no. Okay, Nia and Anne, we'll put you on the spot next time when we can find out if you're watching or not. But we're going to be putting a tracking device on your VCRs. Nia Malika Henderson is a national political reporter for The Washington Post. She joined us from the Post newsroom. Anne Emanuel is a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. She joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting. And here in the Washington, D.C. studio with me, Viviana Hurtado, blogger-in-chief at the Wise Latina Club, and Danielle Belton at The Black Snob. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bracton Booker, Bridget DeShagas, Arjun Hutch, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Eamon Malone, Emily Oxenschlager, Amitha Parasher, Amy Ta, and Sarah Ventry. Our editor is Alicia Montgomery. She had a hand this week from Lori Grant. Our director is Monica Evstatieva. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Neil Tevold. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. The executive producer is Tashima Walker. And to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can also friend me on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.